Well, I needed to really put all of these ideas and practices into a single cohesive plan and into one place, you know, because Onnit is a great resource with a bunch of articles and a bunch of tools and a bunch of, you know, concepts, and we'll put out stuff on social. We have podcasts, but, you know, really that would be distilling thousands of pages of articles and, you know, hundreds of hours of podcasts and trying to come up with what you should do with all that information. And I think that's a big problem with this kind of health and fitness and kind of mindset movement, is there's a ton of information but not very clear actionable steps on what I should do. And I think the real kind of aha moment was when I really figured out that what you really needed, instead of this 30-day or 40-day program, you really just needed to get one day right, because you needed to be able to taste and feel what these practices when employed together in a single day and all supporting each other, which they do. You know, you can't do anything in isolation. Everything works together and builds upon, you know, the momentum of those early choices. Like, put together one day, and, you know, if I could get people to do one day and feel how they felt after that one day, and it's a day that was replicable over and over again, that could make really lasting change. So when that idea of putting it all into one day merged with my real desire to put all of these, you know, pieces of information and practice into one place, that's when the book really took form.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Hey, it's Srini. Before we get to today's episode, I was wondering if I could ask you for a quick favor. If you'd be interested in watching The Unmistakable Creative as a TV show on Netflix, send us a tweet at unmistakablecr or email me at srini@unmistakablemedia.com if you know anybody who might be able to help us make this happen. Aubrey, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Yeah, so it is really great to have you here. So I was actually introduced to you by way of your book marketing team, who sent me a copy of your new book, Own Your Day, Own Your Life, which, you know, it was mind-blowing and filled with all sorts of insight, which we will get into in a great bit of detail. But before we get there, I want to start by asking you, what did your parents do for a living, and what impact did what they did for a living end up having on the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because I had, you know, my parents split when I was 2 years old, so I ended up having four parents, and all of them brought a great diversity of career. But the one common factor was that they were all great at what they did. So my mother was a professional tennis player and got as high as number six in the world, lost to Billie Jean King in the semifinals of Wimbledon. So she was an athlete, and that was her career path before she met my father. And my father was a commodities trader and one of kind of the pioneers in futures trading and commodities in the U.S. and was written about in a book called Market Wizard. And was really, you know, excellent in his craft there. And then my stepfather was a SWAT team squad leader and like former collegiate wrestler. And my stepmother was the nutraceutical doctor for all of Pat Riley's teams. So the Lakers in the 80s, Knicks in the 90s, Heat in the 2000s, and a bunch of other kind of peak performers. So it was a really diverse group of people that I got to learn from. But, you know, I also, more than anything, just got to learn what it would take to be great at anything. And I think that's something that all of them could really teach me in their own way. So I got to benefit from all of that. I was really, really blessed.
So do you mind if we go deeper into specifics about what you learned from each one? I remember the part about your mom being an amazing tennis player that stood out to me in the book. So I'm curious, what did each one teach you about being great at what you do that you applied later in your life?
Well, yeah, I mean, I can go through and talk about each one specifically.
Absolutely.
I think my mom, you know, one of the things that she really taught me is that the amount of repetition was necessary for actually making progress. She told this one story about how when she wasn't happy with how she was playing in tennis, and she's practicing 2-3 hours a day, she decided, I either need to take a complete break and give myself a lot of space and a lot of time, or I need to double my workouts. And that would be like 6 hours a day. And it was actually that choice to double her output that created, you know, her run to Wimbledon and some of the best performance that she had, in which she realized, like, all right, I've been doing as much as everybody else, but if I actually doubled that, then, you know, that might be actually the sweet spot in the right amount. And then, you know, for my father, who is a commodities trader, really, you know, thinking about how to draw correlations from seemingly things that might not, you know, at first blush be related, but that's how he really made a good amount of his, you know, best trades were drawing in correlations and ideas from different fields and from different markets. You know, I think some of his famous stories are one that he saw some activity and Russia was kind of rolling their tanks and getting mobilized for something, and he knew immediately that that would be a destabilizing move for the world. So he bought gold futures, and that was one of his best trades. And it was just like having that instinct, like, okay, what does this mean on the world stage, and how can I apply that? So something specific, how does that affect the global? I think for my stepdad, it was just really, you know, learning what real kind of physical toughness looked like. I mean, that guy, that was just a lesson in how important that is, how important that kind of never quit, you know, physical strength and courage and how to apply that. And for my stepmom, you know, this was, you know, a real opportunity that actually parlayed into me creating Onnit, just to understand how the input that you put in your body affects the output of your performance. And so, you know, stacks of supplements on test day and game day, and watching her work with other elite performers and myself as well, that gave me this, you know, fundamental understanding of the principles by which I eventually founded Onnit.
Mm-hmm. Which we will get into. If I remember correctly from reading the book, you yourself were a high school athlete, correct? If I remember, you played on a basketball team.
Yeah.
What did you learn that you applied later in your life from basketball? And if I remember correctly, it was at Harvard Westlake. And from what I remember growing up, because I think
it was actually just Westlake. It was just Westlake High in Austin. Yeah.
Okay.
It was not in California.
Okay. Mistake on my part. What did you learn from coaches and the people that you played with that ended up, sort of informing your behavior later?
Well, I learned from my coach that basically a bad coach can ruin the experience of anything that you love. You know, and really, my high school basketball coach was one of the most challenging people I've ever had to work with. And I think you learn a lot from those type of people as well. You know, someone who motivates through fear, and understanding how his constant and incessant utilization of fear and punishment as the only real tools ended up getting the worst performances from his players and his team. You know, like, we had some really talented teams and, you know, we had some success, but always that kind of mentality, it didn't yield the best result, and he would break us down in practice. We would not be our best selves for game day. You know, we had a top 25 ranked nationally ranked team, and we didn't win a playoff game that year. And even in our, you know, home state. And that's, you know, really due to, you know, in my opinion, you know, some bad coaching principles. So that was really interesting for me to learn, because I work with a lot of different people and Onnit's involved. I've been in fight camps. I've been involved in a lot of different ways, and seeing, you know, understanding what not to do has kind of showed me the way to do things. And that's been really helpful. But then, you know, of course, looking back now, knowing, you know, what I know now, I just think back to my own high school career and think, I actually did a post on my Instagram recently about it. You know, think back, if I would have known what I know now, how much better I would have been. Mm-hmm. And it's not like I had real dreams of being in the NBA. You know, I don't particularly have the body type for that. But, you know, I was a really strong player, and I certainly could have been even stronger if I'd have known a fraction of what I know now. But basketball was great. And, you know, anytime you're on a team, anytime you put in a pressure situation and a leadership role, and, you know, forced to make these adaptations and, you know, to bring your best when it counts, I think that's invaluable practice for life coming up.
Yeah. I mean, I always think that one of my biggest regrets from high school was the fact that I didn't play a team sport. I was in band. But every time I talk to somebody on this podcast who has played a team sport, it seems like it was one of the most invaluable leadership experiences they had throughout their life.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. I think, you know, it's I mean, band can get there too, though, because, you know, it's just you're a little, your personal performance is a little bit hidden by the group, perhaps, you know, whereas like it's nice to have a team sport where you're together, but also the spotlight is also equally on you, you know, and I think that's that provides that kind of unique pressure. That's really interesting. And honestly, something that I miss, you know, because I have those pressure moments, and that'll be, you know, walking on stage for a big keynote or delivering a speech in some regard or some kind of performance. But it's not quite the same as suiting up with your team. And, you know, in some respects, this is like the closest thing that most of us will have to that kind of going to war with your friends kind of feeling. Like this is your squad, and you've been training together, you've been sweating together, you've been bleeding together, and now you get to go perform together and do it in a safe and constructive way. So it's something I certainly miss, especially doing it where it matters, where there's fans and crowds and emotions involved, and that's where it gets really special.
Mm-hmm. So before we get into On It and the book, I want to ask you one more question. Sure. Having been raised with this sort of, you know, bizarre perspective of four different parents, knowing that parents are listening to this, what advice would you give to parents based on your own upbringing?
Well, I think a lot of times people, you know, I hear parents who they think that the kid needs the parents to stay together no matter what, and that's like the most important thing. But my parents split up when I was two, and it's perhaps the greatest blessing of my entire childhood, because not only did I get more incredible influences, I also got to see, instead of them, my mom and my dad, forcing a relationship that wasn't loving, I got to see two models of really loving relationships where, you know, everybody was happy. And I think kids will mirror what they see. And if they see resentment and unhappiness and discord, you know, they're way more perceptive than we think. And I think if they see that, then they're going to mirror that unhealthiness. Whereas, you know, if you can show them happiness and love, however you want to get it, unconventional, conventional, I think that's a lot more important than, you know, just trying to walk this traditional route. Mm-hmm.
So walk me through how you get to On It. What is the path that has led you there? And this is something I've gathered from reading the book, and it's something that I keep finding as a common theme between the hundreds of people I interview, is that the path to getting where they do is almost never linear. So in addition to that, I'm curious why you think that's the case. Like, why is it that most of these paths are never linear?
Yeah, I think it's because, you know, you get to a different vantage point, and then from that vantage point, you have different options, but you're kind of blind until you get there. It's like, you know, you're climbing, and then you break through, and then you can actually look around and see, you know, things beyond the tree line. It's like multiple different tree lines that you're trying to get above so that you can see what your own skill set is, what the market is dictating, what you really want, who you really are. You know, there's these kind of moments where you just get more visibility, and with that visibility you can really chart your course a little bit better. And sometimes you just get you know, some fortunate circumstances that kind of come, and those aren't gradual. Those kind of come out of nowhere to a certain degree. You know, it's a great connection that you made. And I think for me it was something of all of that. You know, I started an online marketing company after graduating University of Richmond, and digital marketing, and, you know, work with a bunch of different clients and had some success, a ton of failures. Everything I started on my own was a failure. But I had some success for other companies and other clients. And really, though, ultimately, I knew that I wanted to create something myself. You know, I wanted to create not only a company, but a movement. I wanted to create something that reflected what I felt inside, like what I felt like I had to give to the world. And so started and found On It, but I founded it under kind of the pretense that I had to be really unique and really niche and create something that was like, you know, not just something that was like a whole new category. And I think that was an idea that I had to shake myself out of. And when I set my sights to creating Alpha Brain, Alpha Brain wasn't the first cognitive enhancing supplement, but I really set my sights on making it the best. And, you know, so there was a differentiation between that. And I think that was kind of like a key distinction for me, is that I didn't have to make the first in kind, that I could take something that existed and make it better. And that's really what we did with Alpha Brain. And I think that kind of set me up with Onnit. But that was also made possible because of a connection that I cultivated with Joe Rogan, who's one of the business partners in Onnit. And, you know, that was a huge, you know, huge asymmetrical advancement in what was going to make Onnit possible, because he could talk about these things that we are creating, and that would get the word out in a way that was a lot more efficient than, you know, paid ads and doing it the slow, you know, grassroots scale up kind of way.
The quality of your sleep is one of those things that impacts nearly every area of your life, from your emotional well-being to your ability to focus to your creativity. After more than a year of sleeping on it, I think the Casper mattress is hands down one of the best investments I've ever made in the quality of my sleep. Even after sleeping on a bed in the nicest of hotels, I always look forward to sleeping on my Casper mattress because it's made that much of a difference. The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for quality sleep surface with the right amounts of both sink and bounce. The prices are affordable because Casper cuts out the middleman and sells directly to you. It's hassle-free to return, and they offer free shipping and returns in the US and Canada. And you can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep on a trial. Get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/unmistakable and use the promo code unmistakable. Again, that's casper.com/unmistakable and use the promo code unmistakable. Terms and conditions may apply. So one last question about this. You mentioned that everything you had done by yourself had failed up until that point, and yet you still did it. What do you think caused you to make that shift?
Well, you know, fail is a funny word, you know, and a fail is like, I think if you do something to the point that it fails, then you always learn. So it's not a failure. Like the only time that you actually, I think, really fail is if you don't give it enough effort to really know if it fails or succeeds, right? You know, where you kind of get in this middle ground. Well, maybe it would have worked. Maybe it didn't. I didn't try hard enough. I kind of abandoned it. You know what I mean? Like, well, maybe that art piece would have sold if I would have finished it, or maybe I could have sold that screenplay, but I didn't finish it. Or maybe I could have, you don't want any maybes. A maybe is a failure, but actual failure, like full rejection or full failure, like you fund a company and it goes to zero, you work with a company and it goes bankrupt, you know, like you learn something valuable from all of that, and you have no regrets, you know, like even if you made mistakes, you don't really regret the mistakes because you didn't know better. You learned. But what you will regret is just, man, I really wish I would have tried that. You know, I had that idea, I never did it. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that I think we have to avoid.
Well, I think that makes a really perfect segue to actually talking about the ideas in the book. But first, what planted the seed for this book of all the books you could possibly write?
Well, I needed to really put all of these ideas and practices into a single cohesive plan and into one place, you know, because Onnit is a great resource with a bunch of articles and a bunch of tools and a bunch of, you know, concepts, and we'll put out stuff on social. We have podcasts, but, you know, really that would be distilling thousands of pages of articles and, you know, hundreds of hours of podcasts and trying to come up with what you should do with all that information. And I think that's a big problem with this kind of health and fitness and kind of mindset movement, is there's a ton of information, but not very clear actionable steps on what I should do. And I think the real kind of aha moment was when I really figured out that what you really needed, instead of this 30-day or 40-day program, you really just needed to get one day right, because you needed to be able to taste and feel what these practices, when employed together in a single day and all supporting each other, which they do. You know, you can't do anything in isolation. Everything works together and builds upon, you know, the momentum of those early choices. Like, put together one day, and, you know, if I could get people to do one day and feel how they felt after that one day, and it's a day that was replicable over and over again, that could make really lasting change. So when that idea of putting it all into one day merged with my real desire to put all of these, you know, pieces of information and practice into one place, that's when the book really took form.
Yeah. You know, this line in particular was one that struck me, and I feel like it kind of is one of the main theses of the book, just based on what you told me. You said that small things have big consequences. Over time, those consequences compound. We are the accumulated momentum of all of our choices. Some of those choices are binary, go to the gym or not. The choice in that moment is going to change your day. Over time, that choice will change your life. We tend to ignore the importance of fractional benefit because we lose sight of the concept of the tipping point, the little benefit that tips the cup of release a flood of, you know, many benefits. It may be a 2% difference in force or momentum that flips the coin from heads to tails, or yes to no. And yeah, that was, of all the things that were in this book, that stood out to me the most. And it kind of makes a perfect segue to start talking about sort of how you have one of these, what seemingly is an epic sort of day. But I guess the first question for me before we get into specifics is every day of your life like this? Like, do you literally wake up and do all these things, or are you prone to like all the same shit the rest of us are? Like, you know, do you get on Facebook and dick around for 20 minutes for no reason? Do you have days when you eat something that isn't good for you? I had to ask just because when I read the book, I was like, this guy is a machine. I can't help but wonder, you know, is this actually happening every single day? Are there days when you slip?
You know, the slip is built into the book. You know, if you read my chapter on, you know, chapter 12, we're talking about how to deal with excessive alcohol consumption. We're talking about how to deal with excessive sugar consumption. You know, the idea is moderation in all things, including moderation. You know, so I'm way too self-aware to know that I'm not going to be able to follow a strict plan the whole time. Yeah. And I think that's part of this. It's part of the thesis and part of what the differentiator for this book is. So do I do everything every day? No, absolutely not. You know, do I do most of the things most of the time? Mm-hmm. Hell yeah. And the more I can do, the better I feel. And I think that's also another key point. It's not like you have to be owning the day or not owning the day. Like, as I always say, you can be midway through eating your chocolate molten cake and push the plate away and say enough. And that's a win. Like, that's a win. Like, don't think, oh, I'm eating the chocolate molten cake, might as well finish it and just get full gluttonous and then go home. And like, you know, like, everybody has this idea that you need to start clean and start fresh. And yeah. And then from that point forward, you know, I'll clean up my act and I'll do things right. Like, no, at every single point, you can salvage a little bit of a win from making a slightly better choice. So, you know, that's just what I try to keep in mind, is just to try to make the best choice available at all different times and not, you know, not be so strict that like I'm on or off. Like, this is a full-time process.
Yeah. Well, let's get into the start of the day. I think I want to talk about mornings. One, because mornings for me are incredibly precious. I know that my first 3 hours of the day are worth more than the entire rest of the day combined. So I want to talk about one, you know, sort of food and the impact on what we eat early in the morning, the impact that sleep has early in the morning, as well as dealing with attention. Because I'm just curious, you know, when you start, how do we start our day in a way that actually leads to a productive day, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, you gotta handle a couple key things that are going on biologically. For one, while you're sleeping, your body is a very moist environment, and it's moister than the air outside. So by breathing the water vapors out of your system and breathing in drier air, you're going to lose a pound and a half of water. And that's almost enough to start mild case of dehydration right off the bat when you're woken up. And that's going to lead to irritability, lack of focus, and a whole host of different things that'll start to accumulate if you don't combat that mild dehydration that you're feeling first thing in the morning. So I recommend 12 to 16 ounces of room temperature spring water, about 3 grams of sea salt or Himalayan salt, and a splash of lemon, which offers some bioflavonoids. The salt offers electrolytes that are actually going to start to fuel a lot of your organ systems and you know, actually replenish and rehydrate you, not just with the water, but with the minerals themselves, which is incredibly important. And hit that first thing, and that's going to start to rehydrate you and buffer you against any issues that you might have with dehydration. So what you don't want to do is drink that coffee before you drink your water. Mm-hmm. You know, coffee first thing, it's going to jack your adrenals up. It's going to overcome your initial sleepiness, but it's not the right way to do it, because it's using, like, basically hitting the turbo button the first thing you do when you wake up. You want to save that turbo button for when you need it and use the natural forces that'll help you wake up. And so some of those natural forces involve the circadian rhythm. It's what's telling the body that it's awake. And those things are light and movement. So get out in the sunlight if you can, if it's possible, and expose as much skin as possible to the sun. There's photoreceptors in your eyes. There's photoreceptors in your ears. Your skin actually can absorb some of the sunlight. Of course, that's what creates vitamin D. And that'll start to wake you up. And then any kind of light movement, whether that's a little yoga or a couple burpees or some push-ups or anything to kind of get the body moving, that'll also signal that it's time to be awake. And that's not only going to make you feel more alert in the morning, that's going to make you feel more alert throughout the entire day. Like, you'll see that benefit from setting your circadian rhythm all the way to when you go to sleep, and you'll actually start to produce the right amount of melatonin and start to be able to fall asleep with more regularity because you're more in balance with the wake sleep cycle of the human organism. Mm-hmm.
What about food in terms of what you consume for breakfast? What impact does that have? How do you optimize that? Like, what is the ideal way to eat breakfast?
Well, the key thing with breakfast is you don't want to start this blood sugar roller coaster right off the bat. So, you know, blood sugar roller coaster, what I mean by that is anytime that you're going to have a carbohydrate, especially a simple carbohydrate like refined starch or like white bread or donuts or pastries or any of that bullshit, or sugar. You know, that's another simple carbohydrate. That's going to raise your blood sugar really fast, which is going to feel good for a minute on the rise, which is one of the reasons why we crave it. And then, but then immediately the body's going to release a bunch of insulin, whose job it is to scuttle all of that blood sugar back into the cells and back into the liver. And it, when you have a really fast rise in your blood sugar, the body doesn't know how much is coming into your system, so it releases a bunch of insulin. And so that's actually going to crater your blood sugar from all of that insulin, and that's then going to make you feel tired and irritable and when your blood sugar gets low. And so what are you going to do then? You're going to reach for more sugar and more caffeine, and you start playing this game of metabolic ping pong right off the bat. It's like, basically imagine you have like a little piece of bendy metal and you're just bending it over and over again, and you're just going to get metabolically weaker and weaker. You're going to get resistant to your insulin, and you're just going to get more tired, more irritable. You know, your weight management is going to become a real issue. So avoiding that metabolic ping pong and staying away from any kind of simple carbohydrate, especially early in the day, is going to be incredibly valuable. So what does that mean? That means eating foods that are high in fat, high in fiber, and high in protein, and very, very low in carbohydrate. And that's going to help you sustain energy through the more productive parts of your day.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that makes a really nice segue to talking about something that I know you've spent an entire chapter on, which is this role that plants play in our ability to do a whole host of different things, from cognitive capabilities to energy to attention management. Could you give us kind of an overview of the various plants and the impacts that they've had? And I know there was one in particular you mentioned that people in the NFL are using as a performance enhancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, there's three plants that I think we all need to be well versed with, not need to, but we all can be, that are really powerful plants that can be extremely helpful for us. So, especially when you're talking productivity and really getting the most out of what you're capable of. The first one, people are pretty well versed, and that's caffeine. Mm-hmm. And I think the best way, the best form of caffeine is matcha green tea. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One, it has a lot of antioxidants and other additional nutrients that you're getting the benefit of. And two, it contains the amino acid L-theanine, which works to kind of counterbalance some of the more negative effects of caffeine, like the anxiety and jitteriness, and focuses you into a more alpha flow state, which is really what you're looking for from caffeine. So any type of green tea has it. Matcha just has more of it. So all of this whole matcha craze that exists right now, it's there for a reason. Matcha is legit. And then anytime you're drinking caffeine, you want to blend it with fat. And so, you know, whether that's full cream or whether that's butter, or whether that's MCT oil, or whether it's coconut butter or coconut oil, however you can add fats to your caffeine, that's going to slow down the absorption of the caffeine. So it's going to give this more time release effect so that it'll sustain you for longer, rather than just going in your system, spiking up those hormones and then dropping you and cratering you out of the bottom of it. So blending your fats, blending your caffeine and your fats is really important, because fat acts as this kind of rate limiting factor on digestion. So The fat requires bile from the gallbladder to actually break down in the stomach, and that's a rate limited factor. So, you know, the more fat you have, the slower it goes through your system. So that's a really important tip concerning that. And then the next one is actually probably one of the more controversial parts of the book, and that's the utilization of nicotine. And so a couple caveats here with nicotine. For one, cigarettes will absolutely kill you. Like, there's no question about it. Like, there's no reason. And when you look at the cost benefit of a cigarette, is way out of proportion, way out of line. Don't do it under any circumstances. Okay, now that we got that out of the way, let's look at actually nicotine itself and tobacco itself. Now, if you look at some studies by the Royal London College of Physicians, they're saying that smokeless tobacco and other forms of tobacco are anywhere from 10 to 10,000 times less dangerous than smoking a cigarette. So you start to get a lot less danger as far as the health of the health risk. And, you know, that's not to say that there isn't some health risk with smoking a cigar or vaping or doing smokeless tobacco. There is some health cost, but you can also then start weighing that against the benefits of nicotine, which there's a ton of clinical research on, again, for finding that deep focus. And for me, when I use a smokeless form of tobacco called snus, S-N-U-S, and it's been one of the probably biggest performance enhancers and life enhancers that I've encountered. And it's only been recently in the last year or so, actually about 2 years since I started writing the book, maybe 2 years since I started writing the book and doing the research, because it drops me into this really deep, heavy focus. And I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, baseball players like it, and, you know, top performers in the military, top operators in the military like it, special forces like it. It's a really kind of heavy focus that kind of drops the whole world away and allows you to narrow down. And it's quite a pleasant feeling and quite a valuable feeling as well. And also, when I'm thinking about complex problems, it really kind of forms this connection for me to help understand that when I'm writing, when I'm doing different things. So nicotine can be a great ally. You just have to get it in the system as least dangerously as possible. So that means cigarettes never, and that means looking at smokeless options. And if you really want to be a full biohacker, then you would use like a patch like they use for smoking cessation, but actually to get the nicotine in your system. Now, the other caveat with nicotine is that it can be addictive. So you have to make sure to give your body plenty of time to break and wash out and make sure that you're in control and that the nicotine isn't in control and it's not, you know, driving you to take it every day, that you're utilizing it occasionally whenever you need to as a performance benefit. And then the third plant is a less common plant, and it's called Huperzia serrata. And this was the plant that really was, you know, the basis and what I built the Alpha Brain formula around, because it's directly enhances one of the most important neurotransmitters in the brain, which is acetylcholine. And acetylcholine is responsible for mental speed, focus, sharpness, memory. They're using it in a lot of clinical trials, reviewing, you know, all kinds of age-related cognitive decline, all kinds of different things. It has a ton of research out there. But we really wanted to utilize it to help healthy people perform better. And so we built our formula around this herb called Huperzia serrata and created Alpha Brain, then put it through two rounds of double-blind randomized clinical trials with the Boston Center for Memory, which is one of the top institutes in the world for testing cognitive drugs, really. They don't do a lot of supplements, mostly drugs. And we showed statistically significant benefit in a healthy patient population for memory, focus, processing speed, particularly short-term memory. So like remembering those names and places and having that verbal recall, you know, telling a story and be able to access all the different data points that you need to actually pull it together. You know, I use it before every podcast. I use it anytime that I need to be, you know, a speech, anytime that I need to actually be on point. And a lot of athletes use it as well, because there's some additional ancillary benefit, again, as I said, for processing speed, you know, the ability to, you know, just have that kind of mental sharpness and focus. And, you know, fighters have used it to help kind of synthesize those commands they're hearing from their corner and draw those into action even faster. It just kind of collapses the gap between external stimulus and internal process. But mostly it's used for focus and memory. And that's what really people people talk about, and it has no other stimulants in it, so it's not mutually exclusive. You can have your coffee and you can have your Alpha Brain, but it's a really unique feeling because it's focused specifically on that neurotransmitter acetylcholine, which is something that, you know, is not the easiest thing to modulate just naturally. So this is a great solution for that. And so I think if you have all of those tools available from caffeine, nicotine, and Huperzia serrata, which is, you know, you can get from Alpha Brain, you can get it on its own as well. You're really well equipped to kick some serious ass.
So it's possible that you probably don't give much thought to the cleaning products that you use, whether it's dishwashing liquid, laundry detergent, or spray-on cleaner. If you're like me, you probably just picked up whatever was on the shelf that could get the job done. Well, it turns out that most of the household cleaning products and personal care products that we use are filled with toxic chemicals that can be really harmful, not just for our environment, but for our health as well. And that's why I'm really excited about the fact that Grove.co decided to sponsor the podcast. They're on a mission to help every family create and sustain a healthy, beautiful home, which aligns with our mission to help improve the quality of your personal and professional life. Remember that as unmistakable creative guest Jim Bunch once said, everything that you see, hear, smell, taste, and touch is an environment that has an impact on your life, and that includes the products you use to clean and take care of yourself. I've been using the Myers cleaners to wipe down my desk every night before I go to sleep. Not only does this stuff smell amazing, but I wake up in a very zen-like, focused state of mind because my desk is spotless. In addition to selling eco-friendly, non-toxic products, which are vetted to be the best all-natural products around, you get a personal concierge, which is crazy for a company that sells cleaning and personal care products, and they price match, so you know you're getting the best price. For a limited time, Unmistakable Creative listeners who sign up get an amazing $30 Myers gift set, a free 60-day VIP membership, and a bonus gift for you when you sign up and place an order of $20 for more. So check out grove.co/creative for their special offer. When you buy from Grove.co, you're not just supporting the Unmistakable Creative, you're supporting the planet. And that's what I call conscious capitalism. So one question that I had, and I'm guessing probably, I mean, you made subtle reference to it, is what is the difference that you have found, or your research has found, between, you know, cognitive enhancers or stimulants like modafinil or Ritalin or any of these things and, you know, Huperzia serrata?
Well, anybody who's taken any of these other pharmaceutical cognitive enhancers, they'll recognize how stimulating they are. I mean, it's really, if you look at Adderall, for example, it's one molecule away from a straight methamphetamine. And, you know, for me, I take one of those, I'm up for 2 days, and it's hell, truly. And I'm particularly sensitive to stimulants. Mm. And so some people who are less sensitive, you know, they can act, that can be pleasurable, but it's a very intense, stimulating drug. And I think that's, it's crazy to me that we give those to kids, because it's basically like giving speed to kids. But nonetheless, like, it can have, you know, it obviously can have its benefit, but it has its cost. And anything that's that much of a stimulant is going to have some significant tax on the body. Mm-hmm. And, you know, something like Alpha Brain is not a stimulant. It doesn't have, it's not a classic stimulant. It's actually elevating your neurotransmitters, which is like the food for your cognitive processing. And, you know, that's just a completely different mechanism of action. And I think, you know, not having that strong stimulant background then allows you to add a stimulant like caffeine or something like that, that you can really control, rather than using this very kind of hard drug model of getting there. Mm-hmm.
One other area that I kind of wanted to explore with you in a bit more depth, I know you don't give a ton of attention to this in the book, is psychedelics and microdosing, mm-hmm. and what your own research has shown about all of this. I mean, I started experimenting with microdosing mushrooms probably about 3-4 months ago, because a friend I'd met in this like week-long therapy thing had said it had gotten him off of all of his antidepressants. And, you know, after doing it for about 3 months, I noticed, you know, pretty significant drops in my overall level of anxiety, like my tendency to react to things that would upset me in the past don't anymore. So I'm just wondering what your own research and experience has shown about psychedelics and microdosing.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, one of the most interesting, you know, burgeoning fields of research. And honestly, there hasn't been a ton ton of research on microdosing because principally they've been focused on the larger scale clinical trials. So for the psilocybin trials, it's been end of life anxiety and depression. And there's been amazing work done by Hefter and USONA, gone all the way through phase two, showing that dramatic cure rates of up to 80% for people for a single session of psilocybin psychotherapy. So really powerful results in larger scale, you know, small, small-term clinical trial, like kind of structures there, but not a lot of research on the microdosing, but a lot of people who are trying it and a lot of amazing success anecdotally coming from those people trying it. And I know, you know, literally dozens, I've tried it myself on occasion. It's not something that I particularly do frequently, but I can recognize the benefit. I think really what you're doing, especially with something like psilocybin, is you're rerouting actually the blood flow of your brain. So you're putting the priority of the blood flow in your brain to the areas that are going to, you know, less blood flow to those areas that actually cause and are the source of your anxiety and depression, and more blood flow to those areas that actually involve kind of some of the higher thinking, more creative thought processes. So you really, it seems like a magical, mystical thing, and it is to a certain degree. But then when you get down to that kind of materialist, reductionist, you know, viewpoint, vantage point into the body, what you're really doing is you're just emphasizing with that kind of blood flow and circulation some of the higher thinking parts of your brain and de-emphasizing some of those fear-based, you know, systems in your brain that are kind of creating these negative patterns. So that it makes a lot of sense that if you continue that kind of, you know, continue that kind of emphasizing the positive and de-emphasizing the negative aspects, you're going to have a long-term benefit that could yield, you know, the ability to change your pharmaceutical regimen and just change your entire outlook on life. So, you know, I think that makes a whole hell of a lot of sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about what happens when you actually sit down to work, when you get in front of a computer. I mean, how do you set up your environment? How do you go about managing your day when you sit down to work? Like, what happens after you've gone through this morning routine that we've just talked about?
Well, you know, one thing I've really learned to practice is a skill I call mental override. And that's the ability to do what I need to do, even if I don't want to do it. And I practice that first thing in the morning with my cold shower. You know, when I'm up in the morning, I take my shower before I, you know, after I drink my water and get my light and movement, I typically take a shower in the morning. And it's turning that shower nozzle cold. And that used to be something that was particularly challenging. It's just kind of routine at this point. But it's that moment of turning that shower nozzle cold where you're realizing you're doing something you don't want to do because you know it's going to have benefit. It's going to, you know, reduce inflammation. It's going to reduce overall cortisol and stress levels. It's going to help build those cold shock proteins that are going to help with longevity. It's going to just shift your state. But more importantly than that, it's going to prove to yourself that you can do that thing you know you should, even when you don't want to do it. And I think that's the most important thing for me with work, because there's always that thing that we know we should do, but we'll put it off. And I just try to give myself less and less room not to do those things. So ideally, I have a really clean environment, because I think a clean physical environment helps to create a clean mental environment for me. But nonetheless, even if I don't, I have the ability to mentally override. And if I have to write a poem or even write a book, like a lot of those things, you kind of want to wait for inspiration, but a lot of times you don't have the opportunity to wait for inspiration. So I have the ability to kind of flip that lever and say, all right, I'm just doing this thing now. Maybe the place is a mess. Maybe nothing is going right. Maybe this isn't the right time, but I'm going to do this thing because I need to do it. And I think that skill is probably the most important skill.
Let's talk briefly about sleep, because I think that really kind of takes us into the end of the day. I mean, we've talked quite a bit about food. We've talked about, you know, the biology of dealing with things. Let's talk about sleep and kind of how we set ourselves up for a good night's sleep. Because in my personal experience, I found that I had to make a lot of very conscious changes to improve the quality of my sleep.
Well, I think, to me, you know, the point I make in the book is one of the biggest changes we can make about sleep is our idea that we have to do it in a single shot. You know, I think that when you look at the research on the benefits of naps, you know, naps outperform more overnight sleep and outperform coffee in mental alertness, you know, focus, the ability to perform. And but somehow, you know, we got this idea that naps are for lazy people or that we shouldn't do it. And, you know, that if you're crushing it, you don't need to take a nap. Well, that's crazy talk, you know, and I think a lot of us have issues sleeping a full, you know, 7-8 hours in a stretch. And so bringing the nap back in, even if it's just a 30-minute nap, what Nick Littlehale in his book Sleep calls a controlled recovery period, can be vastly beneficial. So looking at the ability, like, all right, first things first, you know, don't think you have to get all of your sleep in the night at the same time. Carve out the space to take a nap. And then additionally, look at sleep in terms of sleep cycles instead of just, you know, blocks and hours of sleep. So a sleep cycle is about an hour and a half. And then know that you can catch up on sleep too. So take some of the pressure off sleep, because I think one of the reasons that sleep, it becomes hard, you know, just like sex, when you put too much pressure on yourself, then it makes it harder. You know, you're asking for, you know, largely unconscious processes to happen. You're asking for your mind to shut down from beta mode into theta and delta mode, which is down regulating. So it's the opposite of doing, you know. So in order to do that, you don't want to put a lot of anxiety and pressure on yourself to fall asleep, because that's just going to make things worse. And that's going to keep you in that fear-based beta state of processing. So, you know, taking the pressure off and realizing, all right, if I get, you know, my goal is to get 30 to 35 sleep cycles a week, so 4 to 5 sleep cycles a day, but I have flexibility there. So if I only sleep 4.5 hours, all right, that's 3 sleep cycles. I can take a nap, which counts as 1 sleep cycle. That brings me to 4. And then I'm almost on par for the day. And then I can just pick up maybe an extra 2 the next day. Maybe I'll sleep 6 hours, get 4 cycles, take a nap, get 5. And then I'm right back on track. And I can start to make up for some of these issues that I have. So those are key things that I really wanted to focus on in the book. And then the other stuff is a lot of stuff that you can find elsewhere that's really smart, like limiting the amount of blue light exposure that you have before you go to bed, removing electronics, making sure that your bedroom is ideally suited, maybe has some house plants for oxygen, you know, has really blacked out curtains to keep it quiet and dark, and that the temperature is nice and cool. And, you know, there's definitely some tips like that. I take some calcium and magnesium before I go to bed, which are some minerals that help me relax and help my body stay relaxed while I sleep. So there's some tips like that. But I think the biggest, fastest improvement you can get to sleep is just take some naps and change how you think about sleep from hours to hours in a day to sleep cycles in a week. Mm-hmm.
So I want to finish by talking about actual implementation of these things, because I know if my first instinct right after I finished reading the book was, okay, I need to go and do all of these things on day one. And I'm guessing, because you get to the end of it and you're like, well, that sounds fucking amazing. I want to be like that. And then you kind of realize, okay, this is not totally realistic. So I'm curious if you could kind of, you know, give people a framework for how to actually implement these things without losing their minds.
Well, really, none of the things that I'm asking for are hard. Mm. Like, not anything on its own is hard. I mean, everything, there's nothing in there. I'm not saying like you have to do this crazy workout or do this super intense thing, you know? So I think really just piecing it out and taking it one step at a time and just having your plan and saying like, all right, is this next thing hard? No, that next thing isn't hard. Is it hard to drink that water with the salt and the lemon? No, it's not. Is it hard to get a little bit of light, 5 minutes, 10 minutes of light? No, I can schedule that in. Is it hard to move around? Okay, no, it's not. Is it hard when I'm taking a shower to take 30 deep breaths and turn the shower nozzle cold? Yeah, it's a little bit hard, you know, mentally, but it's actually not hard physically. You know, you just have to actually do it, you know, but it's just, it's not going to hurt you. You know, it's not anything that's challenging particularly. It's just hard to get your mind in the right place, but I can do that. All right, for breakfast. Okay, well, you know, I can't eat the pancakes, but I can have some avocado and some eggs and some bacon and some bone broth and make a dope smoothie. Okay, I can do that. You know, and then the next thing is like, all right, there's a couple supplements I should look at. All right, maybe I'll look at those. Maybe I can get them naturally, though. Maybe I can get vitamin D from the sun, or I'll just eat more greens or green juice. And so there's different options there. And then, you know, when I'm in the car, can I turn on a podcast instead of listening to the radio? Yep, I can do that. Can I be aware of the type of plants that are available? Yep, I can do that. You know, can I, you know, be efficient in the workplace? All right, you know, here's some principles, I can work on that. Then for lunch, you know, can I eat a diverse, you know, diverse micronutrient rich, anti-nutrient avoiding lunch? Yeah, I can figure that out. Can I have a big ass salad and do something? You know, that can I take a nap? Sure. Can I get a little movement in, some kind of exercise where I'm working on my body? Yep, I can do that. You know, can I connect with myself and my family when I get home? Yeah, I can do that. Can I enjoy myself at dinner and like create the space to really enjoy dinner and you know, set an intention to have that moment where you get to bend the rules a little bit and have some carbohydrate and really enjoy yourself? Sure, I can do that. Can I have sex? Yep, I can do that. You know, can I write down a very quick single page journal of my mission and the three objectives before I go to bed so I know what I have to do the next day? Yep, I can do that. You know, can I limit some of the blue lights and kind of pare myself down for sleep? Totally, I can do that. And then in the final, and that's the day, right? Like I just went through the entire day, all 15 chapters.
Sure.
And none of that was hard. It's just like, it's just people think that it's hard, but as if you take it one step at a time,
yeah,
like you really can get all of this shit into a day because it's a day that's, you know, that makes sense. You know, I include the space where you have a glass of red wine. You know, I include the space where on this particular day you have the cake, you know, like it's cool. Like this is a day that's flexible, but all of the principles you can largely get there. And then, of course, in the final chapter, that's a big key part. You can get there if you feel like you deserve to get there. And that's a key thing is like you have to know that you deserve to change and that you want to change and that you're willing to do that. And part of that is just forgiving yourself for not having changed in the past, you know, forgiving yourself because I think part of us don't want to believe that it's this easy, because if we believe that it's this easy, then we'll punish ourselves for not doing it sooner. Well, don't worry about that. All you have is now. You don't worry about punishing yourself for the past. Like that's crazy, self-defeating, you know, kind of mentality. So just take what you have now, take this newfound information, take this newfound inspiration, and do your best from this point forward with absolute forgiveness of everything that's happened in the past. And you'll be shocked at how much you can get done.
Wow. Well, I think that makes a really sort of fitting end to our conversation. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
We're all unmistakable already. And it's just a matter of not trying to be an approximate or second-rate version of somebody else, but being authentically who you are, because you are completely unmistakable, completely unique, and nobody can be you as well as you can be you. But, you know, if you try to be Gary Vee or if you try to be Tim Ferriss, you're just going to be a second-rate poor version of Gary Vee and a second-rate poor version of Tim Ferriss, and then nobody's going to be the best-rate version of you. You know, that opportunity you have to be the number one, very best, singularly best version of yourself, like you're the only one who can do that thing. So just focus on that. And if everybody focuses on that, the world will be filled with all these unmistakable people and characters and ideas. And that's what's really beautiful.
Awesome. Well, I think that makes a really poetic end to our conversation. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Yeah, definitely check me out on Instagram at Aubrey Marcus. My podcast is the Aubrey Marcus Podcast. And of course, the book, you know, you can check out the website Own the Day Book, or if just look me up on Amazon or Audible. I read the audiobook myself. So a lot of people have been enjoying that. What's one of the top books on Audible. And of course, it's a New York Times bestselling book too. So getting a lot of love there. And I hope people, you know, are interested and want to keep following.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.